So today, we have a presentation by Professor Lowen. Many of you know, he's chair of Mennonite studies and professor in the history department. And today he will present on chapter 3 of his new book project that is called Horse and Buggy Genius on Oral History, which is forthcoming from the University of Manitoba Press. And Professor Lowe will present for about 20 to 25 minutes, and then there will be plenty of time still left for discussion. So, Professor Lowe.
Thank you very much, Mark, for those kind words, and thank you for coming. I'm very honored by your presence. I should make one correction. Having been on so many DPC meetings, I know that the book at U of M Press has been submitted. Okay. It is not forthcoming. So, just to clarify that. And I should say also as preamble that it's been submitted because I was rejected by four other presses first, and so then I finally went to U of M Press. The problem with the book is that I thought that for once I would write a book that people would actually want to read, and so I sent it to four trade presses, and they've all turned me down. Well, one has yet to turn me down. I haven't heard from them. I'm assuming that. And the worst sort of rejection was from Between the Lines. I suggested that this was, you know, they do left of center kind of provocative stuff. I thought this is pretty, not necessarily left of center, but it's provocative. But their website says when you submit, do not expect us to answer for at least 2 months. And then when you get an email the very next day that says we don't want it, then that's a little difficult to take. So they all said it's too academic. You don't know how to speak normal. And so I ran the subtitle past Janice, and the subtitle was Listening to Mennonites Contest the Modern World. And she said, what do you expect? Of course, it's, you know, like only academics contest anything. And what is a modern world anyway, and so on. So she said, this is Janice, she said, I should just call it oral history. And then I was sort of full of a little bit of self-doubt because, I'm a dabbler in oral history. You know, I know we have experts here in the field and so on. But I also had lunch with Alex back in January, and he also said it is actually sort of an oral history. The reason it is not an oral history is because it's difficult to get these guys thinking about change over time, because the project, which was a Schirk-funded project, sent out seven oral historians, young oral historians, in about 2009, 2010, to interview this is horse and buggy Mennonites in southern Ontario, as well as southern Mexico, Belize, Bolivia, and Paraguay. And it's basically a diaspora that had its roots in Manitoba and Saskatchewan in the 1920s when 8,000 Mennonites left for places in Latin America to protest the English language school education laws here in Manitoba. They have now mushroomed to about 250,000 people. One third of them are sort of traditionalist Amish type horse and buggy Mennonites. And although they have nothing sort of they're not direct kin of the Amish. They nevertheless have very parallel life worlds. The little problem with oral history, though, is that you ask, from what I get of oral history, is, you know, tell us about the past. How was the past different from the present? Well, these people don't like answering that question because they say, the past is not supposed to be any different than the present. What are you asking us to answer? And then I say, well, okay, tell me about your life. And they say, my life? Well, I'm a member of the community. I'm nothing, really. You know, the very way you phrase a question, tell me about your life. They don't say this, but I suspect they think that this guy is some kind of person who is caught in a bourgeois Whiggish teleology, and he wants me to kind of affirm his own kind of existence and so on. I mean, they don't use those. I don't think they use those words, but I know that's what they're thinking. So there are a number of sort of problems that I would love to have you help me sort out, as I, in fact, face the bullet and realize that maybe I'm just an academic and I need to get over my that fear. So maybe you can help me sort of on the theoretical part. So this is chapter 3 of this book, and this deals with the migration narratives that the Old Colony Mennonites in Latin America have and talk. So we sit by the candlelight in a home in Colonia del Sur, Bolivia, just 10 kilometers from the Argentine border on a cool winter night in July 2009, speaking in low German. A taxi from Yaquiba has just dropped me off, and Abram and Helena Vogt, horse and buggy Old Colony Mennonites in their 60s, have offered a warm welcome to a perfect stranger. Their unmarried daughters serve reheated soup, and the parents take turns ascribing in soft voices the colony's founding just a decade earlier. They talk of pitching plastic tarps in the bushland, rough boards on dirt as the first floor, a strong southerly tugging hard on the makeshift tent during the first night, and in the morning, the unpacking of goods shipped from Mexico. The next day, I hear from Jakob Neudorf, the stout, unflappable former colony Vorsteher, sitting in the ticket room of the colony cooperative truck scale. The story of legal wrangling is complex, about Jacob discovering too late that the land sale was invalid as Bolivian law forbids foreigners from owning land within 50 kilometers of Argentina. Be pragmatic, their lawyer advised. Simply register the colony in the name of a distant Bolivian-born Mennonite kin at Riva Palacios, founded in 1967, eight hours by bus to the north, and just like that, voila, the colony owners no longer are foreign. This is how dishonest Mennonites get. Later that day, school teacher Benjamin Yinta and I set off on a journey by horse and buggy, 2 hours south to neighboring Colonia, Florida. We have a lot of time to talk about schools and sex and God. Benjamin says that the Florida old colonists are friendly enough, and incidentally, the gentleman on here is from Florida, are friendly enough. But I need to know that they are not in full fellowship with Del Sur. They attend each other's auction sales. Their bishops will shake hands there, but they don't attend one another's churches. Back in 1967, the Florida people were obedient and fled modernization with its symbolic triad of rubber-tired tractors, trucks, and electricity in Mexico, dutifully following Eltister Bernard F. Peters and reestablishing the sacred Ordnung in Bolivia. Unfortunately, the Del Sur people disobeyed Peters, stayed in northern Mexico, but after a generation, they too realized that modernity, that is technological mobility, consumer culture, and unchecked capitalism, could not be held at bay. They too moved to Bolivia, unfortunately 30 years too late, and hence the Florida people shunned them and to a certain extent. The old colony Mennonites of Bolivia, 75,000 strong, readily recall their migration from Mexico in the 1960s, and before that, of their the grandparents' move. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to do some... And before that, their grandparents moved from Western Canada to Mexico in the 1920s. They have migrated to the ends of the earth. Stop by the colonies and ask them about the migration south from Mexico, and they will tell stories of the first days in the tents in the bush and stubborn government officials. But it takes another day, a private audience, a patient visit from another layer for another layer to appear. All three answers come from a single oral history question: tell me what has changed in your life. And the first two will tell you that the change was the migration. The second will tell you that it was the change that led to the migration. The first two describe a move. The third describes a diaspora. This paper reports on just some of 200 interviews conducted by a team of graduate students and me with the Old Colony Mennonites within their own communities in Central and South America. The horse and buggy old colonists left the original colonies in Chihuahua and Durango, Mexico, between 1958 and 2009, when most of the interviews took place. In the 50s, they founded new colonies in British Honduras, in the 60s in eastern Bolivia, in the 70s in East Paraguay, in the 80s in central Argentina, in the 90s in Campeche in southern Mexico, and in the years between, They moved in every which way, although typically ever farther southward and mostly to the Bolivian Oriente and southern Campeche, Mexico. This bifurcated narrative, or disglossic, if you want to stretch a term that means a formal and an informal language, is intertwined in their migration culture, employing Jan Ostman's concepts, I think also communicative memory on one hand and cultural on the other. The first set of stories lie at the surface for the old colony people are folks of the material, of the everyday. They like to talk about pioneer times, but just below the surface is a second story, one encouraged by church teachings, explaining what it is that they, as a horse and buggy people, do, contesting the modern world with sacred symbols. Sit down with the old colonists and ask about the reality of the really old stories, stories conveyed by grandparents from Canada, and the first set seem banal, conflated, imprecise. Catherine Dick of Campeche says, quote, her mother-in-law talked about having to get warmly dressed to go slaughter pigs in a double box wagon. That's the only thing that was ever conveyed to her about Canada. Her neighbor, Martin Martins, of the same region, conflates stories of old and new. Dad talked about how they used horses in Manitoba in the tobacco fields. Tobacco, Manitoba? Not likely. Horses? Probable. Margarita Hildebrandt of East Paraguay repeats grandmother's stories, plowing the fields with horses, so much so that after a day on the plow, her feet hurt so much that almost she couldn't walk anymore. So why are there no machines in Canada? Why only hard-working horses? Is Canada the great betrayer, in part because Mennonites before the 1922 move were innocent? Perhaps, but they're not talking about it just yet. Then ask why the grandparents left Canada in the 1920s, and Canada's presented with a different hue. Anna Banman of Bolivia is imprecise, because they didn't have freedom. Katharina Wolf, actually wrong, because of schools and Militärdienst. Of course, there is truth in their mistakenness. As the old colonists remember 1922, they were protecting a pacifist German against an imperialistic English. But take a bit more time, and a detailed story of Canada as the great betrayer does surface. Widow Katharina Volke of Campeche tells a story of how her father was imprisoned in Morden, Manitoba in 1919 for not sending his kids to school. Quote, "My grandfather was a preacher, and he said, my kids are not going to English school. So they, the authorities, came to get his oats as payment of fine, and he still doesn't send the kids to school. And the authority says, now will you? No, says grandfather. Then they took his best horse. Now, they asked? No, he said. Then they came to the field to arrest him, but let him go home to wash up. And then they put him in jail. Saturday, they got him, and Sunday, they let him out. A man, I can't remember his name, 90 years later, bailed him out, and he got ready to leave right away for Mexico. That my mother told me." It's a story of effect, of betrayal, of mythological proportion. Ask about the migration to British Honduras in 1958, and there's less passion. Even within the longer interview, Franz Penner of Belize recalls only the challenges of jungle farming, the 15-foot-high vines and the wild pigs. Johan Knelson remembers the tarp spread out on the jungle floor to sleep amidst the scourge of mosquitoes. David Friesen and Heinrich Wieb says it was the women, the wife in the first case and the mother in the second, and their desires to be close to kin that took them to British Honduras from Mexico. Sure, there are memories of the first church building, the first altista elected, the bringing of song books and sacred texts, but no one talks about Mexico's Seguro Social, that state policy that history books today say pushed the Mennonites from their land. The 1967 move to Bolivia from Mexico is presented in similarly sort of disglossic or bifurcated narrative. Cornelius Berg recalls the airplane ride that took most of the old colonists, ironically, and his utter fear that the creaky propeller-driven plane from Lima to La Paz would certainly crash, and how three men hung on to one another for dear life. While Cornelius is not hanging on to his wife and his 12 children, he doesn't offer. The Friesen sisters recall the dusty, bumpy ride on the flatbed of a 3-ton truck south from Santa Cruz, and then within the thick bush land at Riva Palacios, the chattering monkeys, the screaming bush cats, the wild pigs, and the sudden floods. But again, another narrative is offered after the sun sets. Peter Knelson says, it all began after World War II, when new tractors came from the factory with rubber tires, meaning that the Jemaat couldn't stay true, the church. If young people found easy access to the city, then a new ordnung, declaring that if a machine has an engine, it must remain on steel wheels, was rejected by the rebels. It all came to a head, says Cornelius Berg of Bolivia, after he's finished his airplane story, when, quote, a group of the excommunicated rebels began entering the church during Sunday service, thus forcing the Aum to end the service. You can't cavort or worship with the shunned. The migration from Mexico in 1969 to East Paraguay is told in strikingly different terms. No mention of either fearful travel or thick jungle, but only of abundant, verdant land. Johann Neufeld says, they came because of the dust of the semi-arid mountain valleys of Chihuahua and Durango. He adds that his father always rued the 1922 migration from well-watered, black-soiled Manitoba to Mexico, Das verdammte Land. But he too is willing to take you a bit deeper. What really mattered was poverty in Mexico, landlessness, and the automatic 10 hectares each poor old colony family received from the Jemaat in Paraguay. Margarita Schmidt seems leery even about talking of the pain of landlessness in Mexico. She wants to share the joy of settling the new difficult land, quote, being more of a boy than a girl. She says she especially enjoyed rooting out the stumps of trees with a pick and pulling up weeds in the field. But there's still another chapter to the East Paraguay story, and it happens 20 years later when thousands leave for the Bolivian Oriente. Now it is about the pain of technology, especially the cheap state-subsidized hydroelectricity from the Aguasu Falls. Leona Reimer, I don't know where Leona got, this is an English name that's not crept in here, of Bolivia, says that in East Paraguay, folks, quote, were starting to use cars and phones, things that were part of the world. Then electricity was brought in 1990, and we got used to using it. That's a bad thing. With a water heater tank first, and then the cheap use of state electricity in Bolivia. In state electricity in Paraguay. In Bolivia, says Leona, we use fire to heat the water and solar panels and batteries for electricity. She says the move is part of the Mennonites' flow of history, the Diche, which is the word that they use in Low German to represent Mennonites. The Diche are like ants, always wandering to new places and will as long as there's room for them in the world. The most recent of the migrations, that is of about 10,000 old colonists from Chihuahua in northern Mexico to Campeche in the far south, and then at least a similar number from the 1967 settlements near Santa Cruz, east across Bolivia's mighty Rio Grande into the Bolivian Chaco, are also presented in two layers, albeit arranged in their own ways. Abram Dick of Campeche recalls, we moved south in the 1980s because we needed more land for our children and obtained 5 hectares of land for each of the 9 children, enough for now, as their own children are little. But Wilhelm Penner of Campeche recalls the influence of the preachers in the process. Yes, quote, our children needed land, but the preachers said that the parents had to go to show the children the value of farm life in the jungle. Helena Wheeler says they moved to Campeche in 1998 because irrigating was too hard in the north, and here was rainfall. But her elderly mother, Anna Thiessen, interjects. It started with the vehicles. And she offers the Thiessen household policy in the issue. My late husband has never sat behind the wheel. Regarding the move within Bolivia, from the original settlements near Santa Cruz, east across the Rio Grande, without a doubt, those colonies, Nueva Esperanza, Oriente, California, Neuland, Valle Nueve, these all represent hope, right? These words of hope for Bolivia's second generation. And there are plenty of narratives outlining the process. Land lots drawn, restrictions on how much non-residents can purchase, the deadlines for occupancy of the new colonies. But older members have not forgotten about Mexico in the 1960s. Juan Wall has a precise date and name. We all moved from Mexico to Bolivia in April 1969 under Om Bernard Peters. Elderly Anna Bannman says they moved across the Rio Grande because, quote, the children moved ahead of them, but she too links it ultimately to Mexico where, quote, the Ordnung broke down. If the mythological migration, religion, and conflict eventually infuse the narrative of relocation, talk about community and religion inevitably returns to the themes of migration. It is as if by migrating, they know that they are on the right pathway, sorrowful and difficult. Their stories are accounts of conflict, of resistance, of uncertainty, but always the migration offers religious and religiously informed hope. Religion is at the foundation of the culture of the old colony. David Friesen Campeche says he once confronted a Mexican atheist. I asked if he had ever been to school. No, he hadn't. Had he ever read the Bible? No, he hadn't. I asked him why he kept laws. He said to stay out of trouble. Otherwise, he would have problems and be put in jail. And I said, who made the laws? The government, he said. And I said, and God set up the government with laws. A strange answer from old colonists who have perfected passive-aggressive civil disobedience, but revealing, nevertheless, a particular cosmology. God's role in history is not questioned, both as giver of death and life, protector and judge. Wilhelma Penner, recalling Campeche's 2002 cyclone, says, quote, it was something amazing that no one died and no one lost a building. God's hand was in it. But the divine also allows tragedy. Katharina Dick recalls stories of the horrific murder of her mother's beloved stepfather, Abram Brown, in Mexico when she was only 14, taken away as God, the Heavenly Father, had ordained it. But God also demands, a demand behind most of the migrations. Johann Volke Campeche says that at baptism, the young people meet with the ministers and say they will hold to God and the church and what is meant the church, the Ordnung. It means that you will refuse the ways of the world. God will forgive the repentant and overlook the errors of the youth. Katharina Dick laments that while, quote, I never thought my children would drive trucks, they are also God's children. But what is unforgivable is the breaking of the vow at baptism to avoid the lure of the world's offerings, of the easy and the handy. These are words they use. Franz Wall of Campeche says, we have no phones or cell phones or radios or TVs. That would be too handy. But what really matters is by acquiring the handy, people are disobeying a promise. Franz says, oh, we have those rules in our mind, and we vow to keep them, and we do not want things that are handy. Keeping the old ways from one generation to the next is crucial, and it begins with a vow of baptism. This conversation returns to the meaning of migration. Susanna Wall says, they moved from Zacatecas to Campeche in Mexico because, quote, we have made a vow at baptism. Susanna's siblings stayed behind to modernize, not wanting to, quote, have such a hard living. Worse is her sister in Canada, who cleans houses, speaks English, and has joined a second baptized church, meaning an evangelical Mennonite church that rebaptizes old colonists. Quote, it is a sin, just not right, going from one church to the next. One should stay in the church in which one has taken one's vows. Just as emigration from the old colony community is linked to religious failing, the return of the prodigals from the north is heralded as a return to the fold. In old colony communities, Donnadagh, literally Thursday, is the day of reckoning. Minister David Rempel says, quote, the first Thursday of the month, when we have a gathering of preachers, the Eltista and the deacons, and have the people who are straying come to the meeting or discuss who will go where to visit and admonish. If something special comes up, then the Eltista, the head preacher, gets the preachers together to deal with it. Agonitha Hebert recalls how she and her husband faced Donnadagh in northern Mexico's only remaining horse and buggy community after their forbidden sojourn in the United States. Given the fact that, quote, they had not lived in the States for long, they did not have to appear at the notoik, that is the public version of Donnerdag, where you are really humiliated in front of people. Others had to do so, but for two Sundays in a row, it depends on what kinds of things they've done, truck driving and having TVs and radios, that gets you to the notoik. One has to believe in God. Reinforcing the promise of diasporic community are stories all colonists hear about their former communities in Chihuahua. Anna Thiessen, a compatriot, says she has read about a horrific accident from back home. With one hand on the steering wheel, five boys have been struck dead there. Those little cell phones, they have them in their pockets and it rings and they are tearing around and then they scream. There is a vehicle in front of them and then they're hit and are killed. The conclusion is simple. Migration can distance you from the treacherous modernizing world. Helena Wheeler of Campeche says, quote, I often say one would want to live where there are no trucks. And Anna, her elderly mother, repeats, my husband has kept his way. Here we sit in Campeche and not one child has learned the ways of the car and the truck. Everything is produced with patience and is still and content. In conclusion, like migrants everywhere, the old colonists' oral histories readily recount their migrations, the hardships of pioneer years, the legal hassles of entering the new land, the building of institutional completeness. But as in all migrations, there is always another narrative just below the surface. For the old colonists, these stories speak of conflict, resistance, antipathy to the loud and the competitive. They speak of sacred vows of obedience that have shaped the migrations. The old colonists have moved ever farther southward to Belize, Bolivia, East Paraguay, and Campeche, Mexico, propelled by church leaders denouncing the throes of modernization. Community cohesiveness, simple technologies, school freedoms, and exemption from all state-run agencies are the underpinning of the life worlds in the new settings. Even then, those worlds are not readily given religious vocabulary, but their very existence is the text on which their religion is inscribed.